The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 20% off during the month of September.
He says he's bringing back socialism. Has Ed Miliband found his mojo as Red Ed?
An ambition that is more important now than it's been for decades. An emotion that is felt across our country, at kitchen tables, every night. A feeling that is so threatening to those who want to keep things as they are. Words that are so basic and yet so powerful, so modest and yet so hard to believe. Six simple words that say, Britain can do better than this. Britain can do better than this. We're Britain, we're better than this.
The Labour leader talks tough on energy prices, the minimum wage and childcare. But has he won over those who doubt he can be Prime Minister? Not Peter Mandelson, it seems. And what about his shadow cabinet with a reshuffle on the horizon? A damp squib or a night of the long knives? And the attack dog that barked. Disgraced former spin doctor Damien McBride tells all, or nearly all, about his time as Gordon Brown's enforcer. Also, a potentially tricky week ahead for David Cameron. Lib Dems to the left of him, UKIP to the right, unhappy Tories as far as the eye can see. How's he going to play his big week? Big questions with big names to help answer them. The Observer's economics editor Heather Stewart, Labour List editor Mark Ferguson, and down the line, freshly back from Brighton, our old friend and political sage, Michael White. Welcome aboard, everyone. Now, Mike, start with you. Did you get a dip in the sea at Brighton this year?
I took my costume, but the tides were all wrong, Hugh, since you ask. At the time of day I can swim, which is 7 in the morning or 7 or 8 at night, sea is at its warmest at this time of year, as all your listeners know. But I couldn't manage it. I was disappointed with myself.
And you didn't fall in on the beach, a la Kinnock, and you didn't attack anyone on the pavement like Damien McBride's publisher?
No, well, I've done all of those things in my time, but not this year.
Well, you're getting on a bit. Let's start with Ed Miliband, or Red Ed, as he must now be known under the tabloid bylaws. The Sun accused him of a chilling left-wing tirade. The Telegraph said he had transported us back to the 1970s. The Mail called it back to the bad old days. I think they still have nightmares about all those Ford capris and mullet hairstyles. Ed Miliband did his look, mum, no scripts trick again, and the thrust, amid the jokes and all the homespun parables, was about the limits of free markets and his determination to stand up to big business. Now, Heather, the energy companies were the villains of the speech, and they came out straight away with their own warnings of the apocalypse that would follow if anyone listened to Ed at all. Did you expect that? Was that part
of
the course?
Yeah, it's a Mandy Rice Davis situation, isn't it? They would say that, wouldn't they? I mean, you know, and indeed, for Labour, it looks great for them to be standing up to these, you know, energy giants, which all the polling and common sense suggests people don't have much sympathy with at all. Most people see that the wholesale price of gas goes up and their bill goes up and their bill never seems to come down. I mean, it's not a market that works very well for ordinary people. And it was a very clever ploy, I think, because it kind of puts flesh on the bones of some of the much more abstract ideas about capitalism and so on that he spelled out in previous speeches that would be quite hard to explain in concrete policy terms. This is a kind of, you know, a very clear offer to you know, your ordinary man or woman in the street struggling to pay their bill.
Mark, people are trying to pick it apart already, particularly the newspapers, but it's a kind of win-win, isn't it? Because even if you can't do it, you can blame other people for not being able to do it, but the aspiration was there.
Yeah, it's very clever, really, because if the energy companies do what everyone expects them to do, which is throw up their energy prices by a double-digit sum in the year, 2 years before a general election, Ed Miliband can turn around quite rightly and say, I told you they were unscrupulous. I told you they want to get around regulation. I told you they're not on the side of ordinary working people. This is exactly the reason why we need to be doing this. They would end up making Ed Miliband's argument for them.
Mike, what did you think? Was it clever politics? And what did you think of the speech as well? Because obviously, you always speak without notes and usually for longer than an hour, but you've seen a lot of Labour leaders and their speeches. Where did this one rank?
Enough of that impertinence, young man. No, I have seen a lot of Labour speeches, and I warn people right away that I don't like big set-piece speeches, like I don't like you know, being in a crowd of 50,000 at a football match, we're all different, and I recoil from them. I thought it was a charming speech. I thought he was funny, quick on his feet, self-deprecating, perhaps too much, made some good jokes, and ad-libbed some good jokes. There's a lot of humour in Miliband. He used the word decency. I drew it to his attention a few months ago. I'd been reading some George Orwell and said, good word, you know, Orwell, decency, and he flinched slightly, and I realised that he grew up in the kind of left-wing household where Orwell was regarded as a bit of a sellout. Never mind.
Are you claiming that bit then?
What?
Are you claiming that bit?
Copywriting that.
Well, no, I'm not copywriting. I'm just saying because I said it doesn't mean he did it for me. But the more substantive point, I'm just saying I enjoyed the speech. People in the hall loved it. But of course, a problem for a party leader is, you know, do you please the people in the hall or do you impress the people watching with one eye on television while making the supper? And my feeling about Johnny Friedland in his Guardian column used a good phrase, left populism. I wish I'd thought of that. And that's really what Mark and Heather and you have been talking about. My worry in a cynical, disengaged age is people shrug and say, yeah, right, we'll believe that when he builds 1,000 houses or caps the energy prices for 18 months. The trouble is with the energy industry, like most of these issues, but that's the salient one, the mail's gone bananas, good, you might say, so might I, is that the world energy market is very complicated and volatile, hard to predict. U.S. shale gas is changing everything. Heather's quite right. They're quick to put the prices up, not so quick to put them down. But there are difficulties in it. For example, they've all come out this morning and said, well, now you can't mention it. The biggest on-cost problem is green taxes imposed by people like you when you were Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband. And unless Miliband can nail that down and hammer them, voters love the utilities being hammered. They hate them in all countries, but he's got to get the small print right as well as the rhetoric.
Mark, it was quite crunchy, wasn't it, in that we've always criticised, or not maybe you, but many have criticised Ed Miliband for not telling us much about the policies he would pursue. There's quite a lot of policy in this speech.
Oh, I think I've probably been very harsh on Ed Miliband in the past for not coming up with any policies. But when people had asked me in the past what kind of policies I would like to see Ed Miliband talk about, the first thing I'd always say is build 1 million new homes. 1 million affordable, preferably sustainable, but I'm not going to be too picky. 1 million homes. We have a huge housing crisis in this country, an overinflated housing bubble that Osborne seems determined to reinflate. Housing is the major drive of the living standards crisis. If someone had told me I was getting 1 million homes from Ed Miliband at the start of this conference, I would have been cartwheeling in and out the conference centre, and I'm not a particularly graceful person. Now we've had that, and it's almost been overlooked because this energy bills thing is crowding everything out. I think we've got a lot of policy here. Integrated health and social care was in there. It was almost a throwaway line. That has been a huge row within the Labour Party about whether or not that can be afforded. Ed Miliband chucked it away like it was nothing in the middle of a speech. Votes for 16 and 17-year-olds. I'm personally not a huge fan of the policy. I don't really have any particular passion for it one way or the other. I don't think 16 and 17-year-olds want it. For some reason, Labour Party conference gave it a standing ovation. But it's a policy.
Mike, you didn't sound very keen down there.
I think is the most irresponsible policy I've encountered from the major parties. Lib Dems are just as bad, and Alex Salmond, the old rogue, is even worse. But fortunately, teenage Scots appear to be 2-1 against independence, so that'll teach you to try and fiddle the franchise and fiddle the result, Alex.
Why shouldn't the young'uns vote? Might not
because
get them interested.
They're kids, Hugh, and when it suits us in the newspapers, we say, child locked up in foreign prison, or child run over. But when we want to big them up, we say, young men and women, you've got teenage children, I think, Hugh, come on. They've got a lot on their plate, exams, zits, boyfriends, girlfriends, relationships, Facebook, football, and the real killer is that 18 to 24-year-olds vote so appallingly badly, about 30%, I think. People my age, we all turn out to vote, and that's maybe why we keep our benefits, but the kids, they're not ready for it, and it's pandering and it's wrong.
That's the thing about Mike, and you can't get him off the fence, can you? Heather, let's talk about Ed Balls, because of course this week he in a conference he said his party would make different choices about what to cut. I mean, we're past the idea as to whether or not we'd have to cut, even Labour accept that, but they would make different choices. Is that a good position for him?
It's a difficult position, I think. I think, you know, Balls made great hay out of the fact that we had a kind of non-recovery in this country for a couple of years. You know, the economy was recovering when Alistair Darling handed it over to the Tories. You know, we then had a flatlining economy for a good 18 months after that, more. And, you know, he had a very, very strong argument that austerity was killing the recovery. it's much harder to make the argument that had we cut a bit more slowly, the recovery would have been stronger. It would have been, but it's a counterfactual, and it's a very hard argument to make politically. It's also very difficult to, at the same time, say, you know, we'll be very prudent and we'll stick to your spending plans, coalition, but we're going to be, you know, we're going to make nicer choices, we're going to make more economically responsible choices. It's a difficult argument to make, and in a way, I imagine there was a kind of sigh of relief when the Miliband speech gave some sort of content to what you could promise the voters, because, I mean, there's some sensible policy there, you know, the idea of using, cancelling George Osborne's planned cut in corporation tax and using that to cut business rates, which, you know, affect small businesses, which don't flex with profits. And, you know, it's one of the things you hear a lot from small businesses as you talk to them, that business rates are impossible to, you know, whatever, they're a huge cost on business. So, you know, there was some sensible policy there, but and he delivered the speech very well and better than he once used to, I think. But it's a tough argument to make, it seems to me.
Because he told that joke, didn't he, about David Cameron wearing too small a towel and being surprised that David Cameron should use
I'm flinching, which won't come over.
I know. Is there a place for Willy jokes in British politics, do we think? Maybe not.
To be honest, I think we were all still reeling from the various revelations in Damien McBride's memoirs as well. And so it's sort of juxtaposed with that, you know, the fewer Willy jokes, the better, is my general policy.
I didn't think it was a Willy joke, Todger Gate, as they're called. I just thought he was mocking him for wearing a man in his position wearing a small towel with a paparazzi. Of course, we weren't meant to print that picture. Some papers did. I hope we didn't. You know, there's an understanding you leave these people alone on a public beach. He's on Polzeath in Cornwall. I recognise the cliffs. I've sold ice creams and pasties on that beach many a time.
I may do again. Heather talked about the McBride book. Mark, we kind of waited to see what the repercussions of the McBride book would be for conference, because it did look like it was going to overshadow the whole of conference at one time. What do you think the impact was?
In the outside world, it felt like everybody was talking about it. And then as soon as you got to Brighton, it felt like nobody was talking about it. The only people I spoke to about Damien McBride for a three-day period were TV and radio producers who'd ring me up and say, oh, you must come on and talk about the impact of Damien McBride's book at conference, all of the revelations that have come out and are going to come out. It's really going to change the tone of Labour Party conference. It's going to colour everything. And I kept on saying, you people are the only people who are talking to me about Damien McBride. The sole Damien McBride impact on Labour Party conference? Liam Dale wrestling a man with a dog to the pavement behind Damien McBride on Daybreak. That was talked
but
about far
it,
more than the book.
To the outside world, it does kind of reinforce, or it reminds people how nasty that period was, doesn't it? And how this was a party that was using, you know, incredibly underhand methods to kind of tear itself apart. And there are senior members of the party who were, you know, who were around at that time. So, I kind of think you're right. People probably weren't talking about it at a conference because a lot of people knew that was exactly how things were going on, and a lot of people would shrug and say that was what Damien McBride was hired for. Of course that's what
Absolutely.
He was doing. But I suspect in the outside world it's at least a reminder that this was a,
sure.
you know, the Blair government and the Brown governments were, you know, not a nasty place to be.
Although not necessarily a bad one for Ed Miliband, because I think the comparison of you can say many things about Ed Miliband and his leadership and the way in which he's run the Labour Party, but I cannot imagine Ed Miliband sanctioning attacks on members of the Shadow Cabinet's private lives implicitly or explicitly. I would imagine if Ed Miliband found out about that kind of thing happening today, which frankly, it just wouldn't happen in the current Labour Party. But if he did find out about it happening today, his reaction would be the same today as it was in 2007, 2009. Damien McBride or whoever, get away from me. I don't want anything to do with you.
Mike, I was really taken by
I wish I could believe Mark was right about that, by the way. It just makes me nervous. There's still enough poison in the system, not as bad as that. That was horrible. But there's still enough poison in the system to be troubling.
Well, how much? What does it tell us? I was really taken by Damien McBride actually saying that if he were in the party, he would have handled his book in a different way.
how ridiculous. I mean, I'm going to do Damien the courtesy of saying he writes a blog. It's rather a good one. He's a clever fellow. I dealt with him a bit, and you know, he's always a bit scary in his partisanship. Even when he was a civil servant, you thought, steady on, Damien. Heather's muttering yes. She perhaps had the same experience. But when the Daily Mail buys your book, it's a Faustian pact, gives you lots of money, 120,000. That's a lot of money to most people listening, and they're right. And you have to grin and bear it while they chop your book up, take all the jokes out, take all the style out of it. He's a good writer. Somebody read a paragraph of me admiringly, and not the piece is in the mail. Of course, he got hold of the book. I haven't opened it yet. I've got a copy. And said, isn't that a beautiful sentence? And, of course, the mail wouldn't print the beautiful sentence. It was just witty and bouncy, good sentence. So I will hold fire on the quality of the book. But the truth is, you sell it to the mail, and they'll do dreadful things to bugger up the Labour conference. They do it every year. Alistair Campbell refused to put his book out for auction. He gets a lot of abuse. He lost a lot of money doing that. I think Blair did the same. Robin Cook, on the other hand, his book ended up in the Daily Mail, and so did several of the others I've already forgotten. You sell your soul a bit when you do that.
Mark Ferguson?
I think Michael's completely right about the way Damian McBride writes his book. Is fantastic, incredibly so. However, I think the real lesson of Damian McBride is that, especially when people are involved in politics at a young age, rise to power at a very young age, operate without much public scrutiny, politics can eat you up, chew you out, spit you out.
Which he admits himself, to be fair.
Mark, do you know the first year Damian McBride went to a Labour Party conference? Guess.
I would imagine it was relatively late. Because
2005. And he's not a child, you know. He's not a 16-year-old voter. He's allegedly a mature man. He's a bit too fond of football, karaoke, and getting completely slaughtered. And he's a repentant Catholic choir boy as well. God help us.
At least repentant.
Well, too late for that, mate, in my vision of hell.
Dear.
That's probably the point at which we should move on from.
Yes, you should.
Very wise.
To Manchester for the Conservative Party's jamboree, because in recent years, Tory conferences have had that rich subtext. Would the Eurosceptics get boisterous and ruin everything? How would Boris Johnson manage to get one over on his old friend Dave? And would the party manage to hide the empty champagne bottles from the prying eyes of the press? I'm told champagne is back this year, by the way.
That's lovely, Hugh. Damian McBride could have written that paragraph.
Oh, Mike, you're too kind, but only on Thursdays. Mike, you're going to go, aren't you, for us? Yep. What do you expect to happen?
Well, interesting over the years, Labour conferences in the late 70s, early 80s was fantastic theatre. I used to say it was like the storming of the Winter Palace in Eisenstein's version of the Russian Revolution. They stormed it four times a day, the platform. And then it went, you know, they saw how destructive it was. Kinnock got on top of it 30 years ago, elected a leader in Brighton. You remember he jumped into the sea to escape. And he got on top and it got dull. Just at that time, as you said, the Eurosceptic business began to break up the Tory party and it got interesting for a while, as it had doing over the breakup of Empire in the 1950s, all sorts of punch-ups before my time, Hugh. But I think they're all too much controlled events. And I thought the Lib Dems were attractive this year because they had a few real debates with real votes, which had some consequence. And they're rallies, really, you know, and they're not very nice. And, you know, Boris will do his stuff, just as Gordon Brown used to do it to Tony Blair, and we'll all have a chuckle. But I think it'll be quiet because they've got to choose, these Tory activists. Do they mistrust and not warm to David Cameron more than they do Ed Miliband? We know the answer to that, and they may even realise that Nigel Farage, you know, is the man. If they support Farage, they're going to put Cameron out of office. Do they want that? At the end of the day, you know, they don't.
But will they do that? I mean, what price loyalty these days? I mean, Ed Miliband has a reasonable conference, and up comes Peter Mandelson to criticise him. Can, you know, Cameron keep the lid on the criticism? He's got UKIP to deal with.
Mandelson's criticism was legitimate, I thought. Mandelson's always worth listening to. It wasn't outrageous. It spun by the newspapers. He just said, we've got to watch it. That's fair enough.
But you were talking about the Tory party being quiet because there would be some level of communal loyalty, but that just doesn't happen, does it?
Not anymore.
Heather, the economic situation is kind of crucial here, economic competence and what people think of the various parties. What do the Tories have to do now? On the one hand, they have a good story. The economy looks as if it's picking up. But Ed Balls didn't have a bad week, did he?
Anyway, I don't think they need to do an awful lot. They can they'll hold things steady and stick to their plans. This is Osborne's repeated mantra, you know, because they can now say, well, you know, we've had a couple of quarters of relatively strong growth. It looks as if we're going to get another quarter or two. Who knows how sustainable it is? But that he can certainly stand up and you know, repeat his line that the economy's turned the corner, that, you know, hey, guys, it's been hard, but we stuck with it. It's been tough, but we did the right things. Here we are. We've got the recovery. I'm sure there'll be a policy lollipop or two. Maybe there'll be something on the cost of living, given that they know that they're vulnerable on that front.
I'm sure there'll be.
I'm sure there'll be something. But you know, there's also nothing George Osborne likes better than being able to paint Labour into a kind of lefty corner. So we'll also no doubt hear an awful lot about how price controls in the energy industry is a kind of return to the 70s, which is a nonsense because one of the government's key policies is a taxpayer-backed subsidy for the mortgage market. So, you know, to try and paint a left-right line in that way, you know, is absurd. But of course they will do that, you know, that's to be expected. So, I don't think they need to do anything drastic. I think it can be steady as she goes. And, you know, congratulations to us, we've turned a corner.
Mark, I was going to ask you what advice you would give them to have a successful conference, but I didn't think you'd be very constructive on that basis. So how should Labour play the Tory party conference?
Well, on the first question, look, conferences are as much about tactics as strategy. Everyone paints them as some sort of grand vision for a new Britain, one nation, Britain can do better. But in reality, they're as much about tactics. The tactics of Labour's conference this year was force the Tories to look like they're on the side of big business, yep, while Labour is on the side of ordinary working people. That has put the Tories into a corner that Ed Miliband wasn't in himself. There was nothing in Nick Clegg's speech that Ed Miliband had to respond to. Cameron will have to be doing rewrites because of what Ed Miliband said. That's fine. Those are the two big parties. Those are the rules of the game. What I fully expect the Tories to do is something, as Heather said, on cost of living. A lot of rumours at the end of Labour conference, perhaps, on the Tories doing something a little bit counterintuitive, like sticking a pound on the minimum wage. That then would be tactically very astute for them, difficult perhaps for them and their party. A lot of them want to get rid of the minimum wage, but very tactically astute, because then, like energy bills have been knocked into the Tories' court, as has the housing crisis, then minimum wage, cost of living, low pay is knocked into Labour's court. We're into a general election campaign now, and that's very clear.
And actually, every time there's any kind of Treasury briefing on economic figures or whatever, they're very, very careful to say, you know, we're very cautious about this recovery, yeah, and we understand how difficult the rising cost of living is for ordinary families. I mean, they're very, very keen to make sure that they're on that territory. But in terms of responding to that kind of Labour argument about standing up for the rich, it couldn't have been better timing for Labour yesterday that, you know, A, George Osborne decided to announce that he was going to go to Brussels to take a legal case against the EU cap on bankers' bonuses, which looks very much like batting for the city in Brussels, batting for the rich. And B, ICAP, which is the you know, brokerage, you know, run by the former Tory treasurer, Michael Spencer, you know, was done for fixing LIBOR, and, you know, an extraordinary colourful set of emails from brokers and to bankers about let's talk about kickbacks over lunch, etc. So it just, that all plays quite nicely, I think, if you were sitting there being Ed Balls.
The sentence in Miliband's speech, which will stick with me, is, it's easy to stand up tough against the weak, but they're no good at doing it to the strong. That can really resonate, because the examples Heather has just given, even though I suspect Osborne has a technical case for doing what he wants to in Brussels, the ICAM business is awful, and the energy price business, where Miliband says he always jumps the wrong way. Rupert Murdoch, I'm on the side of the McCanns and the Dowlers, he's on the side of Rupert Murdoch. Politics a bit rough. But that's what they want to hammer home, and that's what Cameron ought to be scared of. He's not loved. I've taken the view that the election, that one way or another, the coalition would survive this election. But Michael Ashcroft, Tory treasurer, Mr. Moneybags, turned up at the Labour Party conference a bit wary of Miliband's speech, said he ended up on the wrong side of public opinion in the long run. Nice speech. But he said this election is Labour's to lose. It's going to be very close.
And interesting.
What do you think that Cameron will do about Lib Dems? Will it be in his interest to beat them up a bit?
Miliband left the Lib Dems entirely out of his speech, which was interesting because he's playing footsie, or he's trying to play footsie. Hey, Nick, it's my foot. Under the table, Cameron will have to give his own party a bit of red meat, and how he'll do it, I would guess, is to take the mickey out of Vince Cable, who turned up like Jeremiah as usual, and denounced Tory capitalism in terms which Ed Miliband would not dare to do. It was astonishing. Talk about having your cake and eat it. And then he'll probably turn up at the cabinet smiling on Thursday and wonder why nobody talks to him. So Vince is the target to give the Tory activists their money's worth.
Although, as Cable said at Lib Dem conference, Jeremiah was right, for those of you who've read your Bible.
Yes, but he was also dropped into a cistern because his own side got so fed up with him. And it was only after, I can't remember, I think when the Babylonians turned up, he was let out of prison by the Babylonians.
I don't think we'll wish that on Vince Cable.
Well, of course, you can follow all of the events in detail with our political team in Manchester. We expect Andrew Sparrow of this parish to be live blogging from dawn to dusk.
Oh, beyond so, that.
Well, indeed. And you can follow it on our website as well. That's theguardian.com/politics. Finally, let's go back to that conference set piece leader's speech. Nick Clegg got a pretty good reception for his speech. Ed Miliband, as we said, spoke without notes. Who knows, David Cameron might do it again. That's how he got the leadership of the party, if I remember. He kind of pioneered the going on for ages without any notes speech. Mike, do you think it's a good idea?
I don't know how it looks at home, because that's what matters. I don't think people notice. They think there's a trick, because nowadays they know that every promise has been focus group tested and market tested, and every, you know, they've got auto cue. I saw Ronald Reagan used auto cue in about 1985 at Westminster. They all peered at the auto cue and they touched it and they looked through it, and it was a high tech moment for the Americans. But I doubt if anybody will have credited him for that. What I think people look for nowadays, whether it's going to rock concerts because they no longer buy CDs or anything else, is authenticity. They want things to be real and people to be real. Now, Miliband's humour in that speech was authentic. I was delighted by that. It was charming, not something I often said about a Gordon Brown speech. But I don't think that the learning it by heart impresses. Old-fashioned rhetoricians, Churchill practiced all his speeches. There's a famous story of an MP walking past his room and hearing him pacing up and down saying, "Mr. Speaker, I had not intended to intervene in this debate." Everybody practiced, but it's the voters want to feel a connection.
Mark, would you have done it that way? Would you have advised him to just, you know, do the homespun stuff and speak without notes and just get people to see the real you?
The thing about Ed Miliband doing it without notes is that last year it was a big deal. This year it's what Ed Miliband does at conference. It looks not like a gimmick, but it's just, to a certain extent, it's how Miliband does them now. The bar is set.
They're trapped, aren't they? I mean, what if he doesn't want to do it that way?
Well, the thing about Ed Miliband is, I've had people within his office, within his team, say to me, he finds it easier to do it. It's easier for him to learn the speech, because you don't have to be thinking about when you're looking up or where you're looking at certain points or at what point you
because if you're reading, you can get stuck.
Absolutely.
With your head down in your papers, yeah.
Miliband very clearly has one of those memories. Someone who I know worked with him very early on in his leadership was on a train with him to a Q&A near London and handed him a piece of paper, two-sider. Ed Miliband looked at it for 5 minutes, handed it back and said, "Thank you very much, that's really useful." And the aide said, "Will you not be needing to take that in with you? There might be questions." He said, "No, I've got them all up here," and he did.
Oh, lucky man.
Verbatim. It's terrifying.
What we'd all give for that.
Download the speech and then deliver it.
Maybe he should be on the stage at the National Theatre. Of course, the pitfall of this is that you forget a bit, and I think there was one story today which claimed that he had forgotten a bit, that he was going to talk about whether or not they should have another leaders' debate, and that he left that bit out. On that basis, that's supposed to be pretty dangerous for someone like Ed Balls or George Osborne to busk his way through a keynote speech.
Yeah,
it?
And I think chancellors or shadow chancellors want to look as if they're, you know, in charge of the policy and being magisterial, and you have to strike a rather different tone.
A mistake can move markets, can't
exactly.
it? That's the danger.
Exactly.
So we won't see that anytime soon. Of course, we've done this entire podcast without any script at all, but that's all we have time for. Let me thank my guests, Mike White, Mark Ferguson and Heather Stewart. I'm Hugh Muir, the producer was Phil Maynard. Tom Clark will be back next week. Join us next time and goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 20% off in September by going to squarespace.com and using the offer code Guardian.